Welcome to Batwheel, a conversation about symbols, meaning, and practice. I'm Pintu, and with me is my co-host, James. Welcome, James.
Hey, Pintu. Glad to be here. How's it going?
It's going good. I had an interesting epiphany the other day. I started realizing that I judge a lot of people. There's a lot of judgment always going on, whether I want to or I don't want to, whether it's on me or it's on somebody else. I've realized that this judgment is something that, even though I try not to do, it's always something that's in the back of my head, whether I want to or not to or not. So one of the things I have been trying after previous conversations that we've had, practicing my meditation, trying to start the day with an open mind, have no preconceived notions of my expectations or any preconceived notions of, hey, this is not just not to be judgy, if you will, right? I wanted to today talk a little bit about self. What is that? What does that mean? Like, why do I have these notions in my head? And how do we get into the what's a good definition? Where do we start with this? And I want to kind of pass it on to you as we've talked about in the past, a few things that maybe help us describe the self a bit more.
I'm kind of trying to wrap my head a little bit around your story real quick in terms of when you talk about feeling judgy, there's a bit of a meta joke we can do here right off the top in terms of you're already making a judgment about yourself that's making a judgment about something else. So you already right. So you already have this, what we would call a self-reflection. So when we talk about, you know, again, this idea of self, are we really talking about the self-reflection you have of yourself? And perhaps maybe there's even like a feedback loop here in terms of this idea of, I don't want to be a judgy person, but because I'm judging myself, right, it's sort of, it kind of feeds back in terms of, I am a terrible person for having this judgment that someone else is a terrible person.
Yes.
And so when we talk, well, and that's when you talk about, I think, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about in terms of like self, back to this idea of, we don't want to be completely Buddhist here, but we've been talking a lot about Buddhist concepts. And I think we can talk a little bit, we can touch on some stuff that we haven't touched on before. And so if we talk about this idea again of, you know, imagining that potter's wheel, imagining that ball of clay, and again, that ball of clay can be formed. And let's say you form that ball of clay into something and then have a self-reflection, right, of what that something is, you start to believe that that is who or what you are. So if you make yourself into a little teapot with a little spout, you then see that self-reflection in the mirror, and then you start, quote unquote, judging whether you're a good teapot or your imperfections and so on and so forth.
Right. And that's exactly kind of where I'm getting at, right, is it's there. It's there whether you want it or you don't want it, whether you want to stop it or don't stop it, right? I think in the back of my head, there is this thing that is kind of telling me or judging or kind of making assumptions or what have you, right? And I would love to have you kind of talk a little bit about what is that thing, and what is it that is driving me to have that?
Well, again, like if we stick with this analogy, when you say, what is that thing? We've talked previously about, again, this idea of you have this ball of clay and that you might form a bit off to the side and that bit looks back. Because, again, if you're having a self-reflection of yourself, you're still, you know, you're the thing also doing the reflecting, right? And so this idea of what's this thing, it makes it sound like it's something additional, like it's something extra, but it's still you. And so we'll do, I think, I'll give you a choose your own adventure here. I think we should probably start with the three marks of existence. But then there's a couple other Buddhist concepts that we can talk about. And again, recognize that they're metaphorical and that we're going to talk about them figuratively. Yep. One of them is known as the five skandhas or aggregates. And then the other, which is also a wheel concept that we've hinted out before, but this is probably maybe a longer conversation, is the concept of samsara and the concept of rebirth. Because usually when we talk about the self and the ego and reincarnation, there's a very much a non-theistic version of samsara and reincarnation, which is it's a metaphor for an ego journey in terms of that thing that you're talking about at the back of your skull is a bit of, again, this ball of clay that's kind of become hardened and that it's resisting being returned to the rest of you. And because it doesn't want to die.
Yep.
And so in order for it to die and for you to be reborn, this ego that's existential, essentially has an existential crisis, to bring the kind of the French into it. When that existential ego dies, you are now able to fold back and return to the whole of yourself.
I would love to choose, kind of like if choosing my own adventure, let's get into the five skandhas. What does that mean? Tell me a little bit more.
Okay. Well, the five skandhas are essentially the simple version. It's the Buddhist philosophy of ego development. But again, first, let's do the three marks of existence, because sure, they're going to roll into the five skandhas. And I think there's something that we've at least touched upon in terms of one of the marks is going to be dukkha, i.e. suffering. All right. So the three marks are impermanence, dukkha, and then the last one is something that's going to be called no self.
Okay.
And the reason we've kind of talked earlier about dukkha and suffering not being a great translation is going to make a lot of sense here in terms of how these three are going to interrelate to each other. So impermanence is both this idea that stuff dies, but it's also just the sort of fact of nature of things decompose and that energy essentially, you know, transfers from one thing into another, but also for how you perceive the world, all of that stuff is impermanent.
Okay.
And then number two, this idea of dukkha, taking it away from being directly suffering and instead thinking about dukkha as it's a feeling that's related to conditioned existence. So especially when we talk about like the three marks of existence, you can think of the three marks of conditioned existence, right? So in this example, when we talked about, hey, even our thought processes and then the way we see and view the world, even those are impermanent. They're impermanent because they are conditioned. And this mark number two, dukkha, it's a feeling related to conditioned existence. So it could be suffering, it could be frustration, it can be all sorts of, however you're feeling about conditioned existence. And then the last one, no self, is essentially saying, because you're made of impermanent material, there isn't some sort of extra, again, this idea of something maybe in the back of your head. There's no final version of that. There is no solid self behind everything. In the religious sort of example here, it's almost a reminder that you don't, that in kind of, again, this non-theistic version of Buddhism, it's basically saying you don't have a soul. You don't have this persistent ever after you that exists outside of you. It is, you are made of impermanent material and you are a part of an impermanent world. That impermanence has a sort of feeling to it. This is dukkha.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you know, again, like no self almost again serves as just this reminder that this consciousness, this ego, this self, it's impermanent, it's malleable, it lives and it dies. And so, go ahead.
And is it self-created? Like, am I just making stuff up in my head based on what I'm seeing?
And so this is how we transition to the five skandhas, otherwise known as aggregates or bundles. And again, the classic reminder here, the caveat for everything. So we're going to talk about this and we're going to remember that it's a metaphor and that it's figurative and that it's an idea that's over 2,000 years old. So there's going to be some science that's it's actually going to touch upon that's more even applicable in today's world. But okay. the lines aren't going to be super literal and we don't want to take them literally. So we'll do the thing again where I do what the five are and then we can step through them. And I'm just going to do these in English. So number one is form. Number two is sensation. Number three is perception. Number four is mental formations. And number five is consciousness.
Okay.
So now stepping through form, we're back to impermanence and we're back to just the idea of stuff. And again, in this idea of thinking about this metaphor and how we're explaining the world, this is physics. There is matter and that there is forces and that there's external stuff and then there's internal stuff, but it's all made of the same stuff. Form is just all of the stuff of existence.
Right, but physical, like actual.
The real atoms. Material.
Okay.
And covalent bonds and and the key here is that, you know, these skandhas, this is an actual area where this idea of aggregates, we're going to aggregate up. So each aggregate is going to be made of the prior item.
Got it.
So form is, yes, the you live in a world and you are surrounded by stuff, made of stuff. But now you're going to think about and interact with that stuff. And how does that all happen? Well, that happens through sensation. So sensation is essentially when all of that form hits your sense bases.
Right.
And so this is all the information getting translated. Again, thinking metaphorically about what we're trying to talk about back then to scientifically today. I mean, we're talking about neural connections. We're talking about like that we're now touching upon your actual central nervous system in terms of receiving a message. And that message is going to start getting processed and it's going to start getting processed up the chain. And so the next skanda, perceptions, again, it's an aggregate of all this. It aggregates all of what's beneath it. So it aggregates all of those sensations into perceptions. Here, we're very metaphorical, but we have some sort of, we have a few examples in today's world that are fun in terms of when we think of perceptual illusions. And you can think about, you know, these layers of pre-processing that are below your conscious mind where you there's nothing you can do about them. So two examples that I like to use is there's a visual illusion called Allison's checkerboard where you, because of the way when you're looking at a shadow, you're going to perceive a color difference that's not technically there, but it's something that your brain has done. You know, it's an evolutionary, essentially survival technique. The one that's more applicable from like a pop culture perspective that we're familiar with, but it's like 10 years old now. How old is the, how old is the white or gold or blue and black dress?
I think it's got to be at least 15 years.
I don't know. Wow. Anyway, I'm still calling that the modern reference. So again, this idea of you see one version or the other, and you have no control over it. It's simple matter of depending on how your visual, you know, cortex basically processes information, and it's a decision being made at a lower level in terms of light and shadow.
Right, right.
The moral of the story is as we're aggregating up and you're asking, you know, like where do we get all of this conscious stuff, right? Well, again, it's aggregates. It's stuff built off of other stuff. So if we just imagine this idea, you know, in terms of trying to map this metaphor to modern cognitive science, you can see the relationship in terms of, yeah, we have all of these pre-processing layers that we don't have control over, but they do stuff. They take information from the outside world and then they create an answer and then they provide that answer up the chain.
And right. So,
right. The next level up the chain, mental formations begin to, in mental formations, this one's sort of that term. Sometimes you'll see volition here. Here's where you can get into kind of like the idea of maybe subprograms or habitual programming in terms of items that you can train your brain to do. But then when you do them, they're operating, quote unquote, subconsciously, right? You're not thinking about them, but you're doing them. You're performing them.
Yep.
And this is kind of the mental. And so here's where you get a lot of concepts like language, you know, again, like particular types of training. So the reason why volition exists here, when we've given examples of like learning to play, say, you know, a musical instrument, and you get to a point where it just sort of plays on autopilot, right? That's that's this layer where you have these. Again, I like to think of them as almost like subprograms in terms of, again, perception is now aggregating up, but we still have all these like buckets, and you have this bucket that you basically can, you know, press play and it says, you know, like, you know, perform this activity. Or right now, you know, I'm using language and all that, this language, right, has been trained to a point where I'm more thinking conceptually about where I'm going and trusting, hopefully, that my mouth is working correctly.
Right. And then there's a lot of that, right? The volitional acts. I mean, one thing that you and I've talked about is when sometimes I'm driving to work and I'm like, I got here. Yeah. How that happened? I mean, I guess it just happened because I did it, but you know, it's just through so many repetitions and things that I've done, I just ended up there, right? Or another simpler example is, you know, getting up, walking to a spot, like you're not really thinking about the actual steps of going there. Like, and how are you going to move your legs or whatever else? You just do it.
Exactly. And so, again, this idea of aggregates, bundles, stuff that's collecting, and then we're moving up the chain. All this stuff is still a part of you, even when it feels like it isn't, right? Even when it feels like it's quote unquote subconsciously,
right?
It's still there, you know, from, again, this cognitive science, you know, level. And so, yeah, we're incorporating kind of, you know, like physics and you know, again, biology from this metaphor all the way up to now psychology,
right?
Which is level 5, consciousness, which is this executive function that has opinions and judgments and has the capability to write, you know, subroutines down in the mental formations layer. Mm-hmm. And again, this idea of when we think about no self and self, most of the time when we get up all the way up into consciousness, even the part that we're calling self isn't just being conscious and aware. It's, again, being aware of yourself within the context of everything else that you're aware of. So you get into this idea of we are a species that has self-reflection. We are, quote-unquote, self-conscious. And that self-conscious entity then is the main thing that we end up actually talking about when we talk about ego or, quote-unquote, self. It's
right.
This creation, and it's actually at the kind of the top of the consciousness layer, because we've created something and we've almost, you know, moved it off to the side. Here's a kind of left field example. There's something called a tulpa, and tulpas are fun. People might have heard of them from like David Lynch and Twin Peaks, but the idea of a tulpa is essentially that you've created, it's almost an imaginary friend, really. It's this idea that you're able to create this ego, this character with inside of yourself, and then almost can have, you know, just like a conversation with this character, but feel like you're separated and have no self-control. But the idea, again, to kind of like always return back to the idea of the no self, is no matter how much you've created this other thing, it's still an illusion. It's still a hallucination of consciousness, because again, if we just remind ourselves that we've just been aggregating the entire time.
Right.
And including like at multiple points where we had no choice in the matter. So go back to the dress, right? We know now that the dress, if quote unquote officially, is a certain color. It's only looks different to certain people, given that the way that the image was taken, and again, the way the light is cropped in it. But if you can see that dress in a different light, you go, oh, okay, I had this visual processing error. And same thing with the checkerboard illusion. You can find out that it's an illusion, and you can see the example of how it is an illusion. It still doesn't change what you see, though. You still see this illusion. And so if we just remember this, we can keep this reminder that, okay, our entire consciousness is a self-created simulation of the world around us. And it's filled with imperfections. It's filled with uncertainty. It is this hallucination that it's trying its best, right? Like the actual physical mechanism is doing the best that it can, given the information that it has. But we're constantly also injecting into it ideas, preconceived notions, concepts.
Right.
I don't necessarily think we should go too far down this rabbit hole, but I do like there is a tangential connection to Western philosophy in terms of David Hume, because he's got a whole treatise that's in like 1700, and I can't remember the actual date, but he talks about this bundle theory of consciousness. He embraces this idea, and he talks about things like impressions and images, how you receive impressions of the world around you, and then you project out an image of that impression over the current reality to kind of basically map back to it, define essentially like discrepancies in terms of just, again, like how you think about what the world is. It's kind of his theory in terms of how you're updating essentially your cognitive simulation of the world.
And does that, like, is this almost like your brain, your consciousness is doing this for more like shortcuts, or is it more like something else?
Yeah, from a, I think if you'd asked, if you know, we talked to like an actual cognitive scientist, they would say it's basically a form of shortcuts, in terms of, again, going all the way through the five, right? When we return to one and we're at form, we're talking about everything, everywhere, all at once. Again, we're talking about physics, we're talking about quantum physics, we're talking about, you know, matter and things move, and that the universe is filled with information and entropy, and you can only process all of this stuff so well. And that's why this sort of theory of the five skandhas has this interesting, again, way to see it figuratively in today's world, in terms of you're every time you aggregate up, you can think of it in a computer science sense of, you know, reducing, you know, the information, collapsing the information. So like an MP3, right? You're taking a file that originally had a source that had much more information, much more fidelity, and then you're collapsing it into a smaller file type. Well, and then again, so per all these layers, we're constantly sort of simplifying information in order to process it. Because yes, from an executive layer function, it's very impossible to process
everything.
Yep. Yeah, everything happening around you. But the key here is your brain always does give you an answer, because it has to. It's receiving all this information. It's making all of these early decisions. And, you know, often I tell this example that's sort of traumatic, where when people are in scenarios that are so dramatically unfamiliar to them, their brain has to give them an answer of what is happening. And that answer is almost universally always incorrect, because the brain is just going off of the logical assumption of what should happen next. And if you're in an absurd scenario or something, again, that's really dramatic and drastic, that your brain hasn't encountered before, your brain will give you an answer. Answer will be wrong. but it's always giving you an answer. And so this comes back into this idea of, that's why no self and impermanence and all this stuff is important, is just remembering this idea of like, okay, I'm going to get a response from all of, you know, the information I've previously received.
Right.
Again, all these impressions of the world are going to create these images, and these images are essentially references, the reference information to how I understand reality. And then it's going to overlay reality, and then reality will either agree or disagree with that information. And here's where you have a little bit of conscious control. Like, the moral here would be how how little your consciousness actually, you know, controls a bunch of this stuff. But here's where you do have that small capability of, if something is surprising or unique,
right,
if it defies expectations, here's an ability to update your image reference. And so even when we talk about on another time, the idea of an ego journey and shedding the ego and all that other stuff, usually the idea here is that this ego state is a very elaborate reference of the world, and that refuses to go away. It refuses to change. And so when it's so unbelievably solid, usually its death needs to be somewhat violent, and that becomes sort of, you know, like a rite of passage, if you will. But yeah, that's the idea here, is that these images, impressions, they
yep.
get set over time, but we have to be able to be flexible to updating them.
Yep. And recognizing that was the wrong answer, or being able to be conscious enough to recognize that, hey, my brain took a shortcut, and maybe that shortcut isn't the right shortcut that I need to take at this point.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, as you get older, you know, things, I think, make less sense in terms of, you have regular reminders at middle age that are funny jokes that we all kind of talk about, in terms of the experience of walking into a room and forgetting why you walked in there to begin with.
That never happens to me.
So yeah, you have an impermanent brain. And it's good to remind yourself that yourself is impermanent, especially if you feel like you're being, if I can try to get us all the way back to the beginning here.
Yeah.
So this judgmental personality or this judgment, right? Like, what are you judging in terms of, are you judging a system? Are you judging a person or personality, like, you know, individual traits? How rational is your judgment?
Yeah, it could be behaviors, right? It could be personalities. It's just little tiny things. It could be physical form, right? So, for example, you see trash on the ground, you're just like, wow, that's... And then that leads to, oh, this must mean that this person is a dirty person, right? I mean, it's just kind of jumping to that kind of conclusion opposed to, wait a minute, let's take a step back. And, you know, just because there's a mental, you know, it's an act or something I see, I'm now starting to perceive that, hey, X, Y, and Z is the real reason. And I think the mental formation and or the consciousness kind of combined together is starting to formulate more of that, I don't know, that judgment, if you will.
Well, and again, I think part of the idea here in terms of thinking about judgment of a something versus judging the something in reflection of somebody else, right? So I know you wanted to get to mantras at some point. We can do that on another pod.
Yeah.
One of the mantras that is common in Buddhism, or this one's more of just an expression, but it's this concept called take care, in terms of once you're aware of the world, it's now your responsibility. That's kind of the, you know, when people talk about what it is to be enlightened or whatever, well, there's a challenge here of once you're aware of something, you can't now choose to ignore it because you're responsible for it. You're aware of something. So when you talk about a piece of a trash on the ground, there is this idea of, if you think that is in the, you know, again, from a judgmental perspective of just, we're trying to create a holistic system. And this holistic system is always going to be made of, you know, this grand scheme. But that grand scheme is always made of parts. Again, this idea of aggregates and bundles of, if I want a clean neighborhood, you know, city, park, etc., and there's trash everywhere, I can sit there and do nothing about it and judge everybody in reflection of that. Or I can pick up the trash and throw it away and then just move on. Like it's this extra ruminating part that doesn't do that. When we say what is a productive way or to be, ruminating, like if you just sit there and leave the trash and then ruminate on the terribleness that exists and but never do anything about it.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, it's kind of like one of those things where when you know it, you really can't unknow it, right? And it's like one of those things, but I would challenge you in terms of, once you know it or you see it or you kind of experience it, you can't unsee it or unknow it, is maybe that in itself is a challenge, where maybe, like, for example, back to the piece of trash on the ground, maybe, you know, you can take away that, sure, you can pick, like your point, you can pick it up, throw it away, whatever, and like let it be. Or the other one is, maybe my first notion or that thought in my head of, wow, this place is dirty, right? And or whatever it is, whatever that, maybe that's where the problem is, and I need to not have that thought to begin with, period.
Well, and here's now, where yeah, but again, here's this idea, right? Of I kind of mentioned another concept that's maybe a conversation for a different day in terms of I briefly said I think whole systems thinking. I like to say that versus holistic thinking, which is because the word holistic means something a little bit different. But this idea of take care is again more of thinking it's not just you. It's you and the time and the place and everything else in terms of this is the idea of being aware of stuff and what things quote unquote are mm-hmm. in terms of, all right, well, if you're in a hospital, it might be a pretty good judgmental quality to evaluate.
You see everything all the ground, all over the place.
Yeah, whether things are clean or not. Part of this idea in terms of, and this is why I think, again, talking about something as simple as a piece of trash that you can pick up and throw away, is that, you know, does this fundamentally improve something and that you're capable of doing, and the energy you spend thinking about it is more than the energy that it would take just to quote unquote take care of it. That's right. Usually kind of, you know, a good indication that, you know, I can complain about something, or I could send an email, or I can put something off. And all of this energy is put into not doing something. And for some reason, that not doing something energy is more than it takes to actually just take care of something. That's kind of what the philosophy is more about.
For the take care portion, right? Basically, you're trying to say do the thing instead of being judgy of whatever it is that you're looking at. And take care of it, and you know that don't ruminate on that and the actual negativity of it.
Yeah, and especially this will also be something that can feed into the concept of talking about samsara and karma and regeneration. Is this idea that if you're again carrying this extra energy forward, this additional energy that's again the thought of the bad people and the bad things versus just taking care of the immediate problem, then that affects how you're quote unquote reborn in your next life, which really just means that, you know, tomorrow, which is just the you you're going to be tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Yep.
Is going to be upset, and that you, and this is where you kind of think about how can stuff then quote unquote piles up, aggregates, right? Well,
yeah.
Now there's five pieces of trash on the ground, right? And it just keeps going from there.
Yeah, and then instead of it aggregating that way, you can stop that cycle, right?
Yes.
And actually make it something better, right? So that's the kind of like the whole reincarnation portion, right? It's not like a physical, like a real actual person. It's actually the death of that particular cycle that you want to actually stop. And it kind of goes back to the whole, you know, you feel pain or suffering and the you know context and kind of the aggregate or your specific sensation or kind of feeling of the world, but there is a way to stop that, right? And kind of stopping that cycle.
100%. And that's why I think you've nailed the short version. The reason there's a longer discussion on samsara is it's the wheel of life. Is the way to think of it. And it's got multiple components. It's got an outside that's got 12 parts. And then there's the realms. There's six realms you're born into. And then there's a middle section. So in order to explain the whole wheel, it takes maybe like a full hour. But the short mm-hmm. version is exactly what you just said. It's your rebirth, your next version of your ego-constructed conscious self is based right. off of what you're carrying through your quote unquote karma. And so, yeah, if this is sort of like, you know, the cheesy version is going to bed angry. Right. And then waking up angry.
Right. Exactly. Right. I think we won't cover it here, but I think there's a notion what I was getting at earlier, which is you see something on the ground, you can be judgmental about it, right? And you can be like, oh my God, this place is, or this thing is dirty, or this people are dirty, whatever else. I think there's a portion of me that I feel like, and I'm sure this is somewhere in conversations that we can have, which is, how do you take that, right? And I think we discussed it a little bit, is like, hey, do something about it, take care of it, right? The other thing I want to kind of get into, which has been like the norm across, you take a look at all the like the kind of general kind of feeling around, oh yeah, you know, gratitude is super important and all that stuff. I think there is something there. I think like understanding the why or how that might have gotten there, and having that empathetic view into what you're looking at, and that feeling or mindset that you may have on a specific thing, does serve some, you know, possibility of you actually getting to the action of taking care of it, right? So, for example, one thing which is stuck with me, which is around, you can be grateful for a lot of things that are around you and not judgmental of them, is it helps you A, kind of realize that you're being, you know, A, judgmental, but also B, helps you appreciate the things that, you know, it doesn't have to be there. Like there's a lot of things that could be a lot worse, and, or, you know, I think if you're doing things to take care of it and actually helps you understand the world a little bit better. Retrain your brain, in terms of how and what you look at, when you look at it.
Right. So again, some of the things that we've kind of touched upon in terms of, you know, I referenced Hume and this idea of you have impressions and that you have images and that you sort of project, you know, out into the world. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times when we're talking about whether it's gratitude or it's loving kindness, you're talking about almost this idea of an injection, in terms of we're trying to inject an idea into our consciousness to then, yes, change maybe some stuck, you know, formations.
Right.
And again, when we do the samsara conversation, and we do talk about, again, ego journeys, I'll bring up Joseph Campbell again, in terms of the idea of at a certain point when the ego gets too big, there's a, you know, a massive thing that needs to be done to it. And so part of the idea of being more gentle or more, you know, a middle way, third path, is that by using these particular meditation practices, we're trying to change, you know, modes of being. And it helps usually when someone is doing, say, like a gratitude practice, is that you're trying to place gratitude in a specific spot in your mind.
Okay.
To try to rewire what is, again, come, you know, trying to always take these metaphors from, you know, what they figuratively are, and then imagine what they look like physically, you know, in your body. You know, you have these neural connections that are trained, right, in your brain, and you're trying to get them to potentially flip, right, from a negative point of view to a positive point of view. You know, that's an exercise of training. That's, you know, there's, right?
It definitely is. And I think, I mean, we can definitely cover that a little bit on the ego side as well. But yeah, I think we covered a reason. I mean, we covered, you know, form, feeling, perception, mental formations and the consciousness, which will eventually kind of lead to some level of judging, right? But like you mentioned, it's this thing that's your clay wheel, right? You're kind of forming that. And this is not your judgmental is not like a separate thing from it. It's one of the same.
Yep. There's that, you know, it exists. It's still part of you. And it is created via this sort of, you know, path of self-reflection. And, you know, the final sort of sign-off note from my end would be, Chogram Tupal's got this example that's a little bit weird when it comes to the five skandhas, but I'll do it briefly just because it's just fun. So he likes to talk about this idea of a monkey that has suddenly woken up inside of a house, but it doesn't know how it got there, right? So it can reach out and touch the walls, right? It can feel it. It can perceive it. It can have ideas about it, and it can have thoughts about what the situation is, right? Like it can start labeling things and giving those ideas reasons. But at the end of the day, the house that this monkey is in was created by itself. It's this big hallucination,
right,
that surrounds you. And the illusion is that, you know, you believe it's real to a certain extent, where, again, when you start chasing the self-reflective ideas, the image overlays, I know how I am in terms of I complain about when anyone says the way something is, or this is the way the world is. That's not ever true. That's just, again, an idea that you are, you know, reflecting in a sort of self-biased way. If anyone wants to look that up, I'm pretty sure you can pick up his Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism book. I believe it's in that one.
Yes, that's pretty well said and a really good example, because it is kind of like you said. I mean, it's based off the five skandhas and based on the fact that you have this thing in your head, and you have a lot of preconceived notions for a lot of things, and your brain has really gotten you there, not really anyone else, and you may have a separate opinion than what reality may be in that case. Well, with that, I do appreciate the conversation. Thank you for indulging me in my conversation about judgment. This was very helpful for me to understand it on a more granular level, as opposed to just kind of like, well, yeah, we shouldn't have judgment. So
thanks, Pintu. Take care.
Thank you.